everyone. Welcome to week 5 of our time with How to Be an Anti-Racist. Let's start, as always, by taking a deep breath, maybe combining it with a nice stretch, inhaling slowly and deeply, and exhaling. Good work. Okay, today I'm going to be talking about our week 5 reading, which is chapters 10 and 11. These are very interesting chapters, at least I found them to be so interesting and challenging. So let's dive right in. Chapter 10 is called White, and Ibram begins and ends this chapter by telling us about one of the many times in college when he went to his friend Clarence with a new insight, idea, or aha that he wanted to share. And given that this chapter is about white people, his insight is that, wait for it, white people are aliens. He says that this explains slavery and colonization and why white people don't give a damn. And this made me chuckle. And ironically enough, it also gave me hope for humanity. Because I love how transparent Ibram is in telling stories about how who he used to be compared to who he is now. I find it to be a beautiful example of the growth and evolution that's possible for a human mind within a relatively short time span. Because if Ibram can go from white people are aliens to writing this book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, in 15 or so years, what kind of growth am I capable of? Or you, us as a collective? Like, maybe our country will completely look different just 15 years from now. Who knows? I mean, that's a pretty big leap in 15 years from white people are aliens to his thinking currently. So I say that, and I also know that everybody is not as committed to learning as Ibram is, or as I am, or as you are. Those of us here are actively engaged in learning, and not everybody is. But I do think of the idea of the tipping point, which is the scientific model that found that when 10% of the population holds an unshakable belief, that belief will end up being adopted by the majority of society. So if we look at it that way, maybe there's hope. And I do feel like, in a way, I'm seeing that happen. Like, people I know keep surprising me. People who maybe a year ago or even 6 months ago, I would have said, like, oh, I think they're pretty set in their views around race, and I don't think they're really going to evolve or change. They keep surprising me in the way that they're coming around. And my hypothesis is that this must be because they're seeing more and more people in their lives who are expressing support for Black Lives Matter, or who are reading White Fragility, or whatever it is. They're seeing all of that stuff come into the consciousness of more and more people they're around. And when you see multiple people in your social circle taking these steps, it's just natural that you start to move in that direction as well. So that's good news. Of course, there could be the opposite argument, like that there's a solid 10% that strongly believe in the opposite of these ideas, and that they'll be the ones whose ideas will take over in the mainstream. So there's that. And, you know, if I'm learning, one of the things that I'm just being reminded of as we dig into this book is, like, we must look at reality with clear eyes. And for me, it's a constant practice to do that while also maintaining hope that what I consider to be the, quote, right side of history will eventually prevail. And more, I'm leaning on Brené Brown's teaching that hope is not a feeling, it's an action. That's helpful for me to remember and remind myself of over and over again. And then, of course, on a deeper level, there's a spiritual sense that everything is happening all at the same time. And I was musing on this, and I grabbed the book Coming Back to Life off my shelf, which is by co-authors Joanna Macy and Molly Brown. And I just wanted to read an excerpt that relates to this topic. So they write, "In the industrialized world today, the most commonly held stories seem to boil down to 3. We have found it helpful in workshops to present these 3 stories as all happening right now, In that sense, they are all true. We can choose the one we want to get behind, the one that seems to hold the widest and most useful perspective. So number one is business as usual. Business as usual is the story of the industrial growth society. We hear it from politicians, business schools, corporations, and corporate controlled media. Here, the defining assumption is that there is little need to change the way we live. The central plot is about getting ahead. Economic recessions and extreme weather conditions are just temporary difficulties from which we will surely recover and even profit. And then there's the Great Unraveling. The Great Unraveling is the story we tend to hear from environmental scientists, independent journalists, and activists. It draws attention to the disasters that business as usual has caused and continues to create. It is an account backed by evidence of the ongoing derangement and collapse of biological, ecological, economic, and social systems. Finally, there's the Great Turning. The Great Turning is the story we hear from those who see the Great Unraveling and don't want it to have the last word. It involves the emergence of new and creative human responses that enable the transition from the industrial growth society to a life-sustaining society. The central plot is about joining together to act for the sake of life on Earth. So that's something I've been thinking about a lot, how, you know, all three of those are happening at the same time. And right now in our country, we're seeing racist progress and we're seeing anti-racist progress at the same time. And one of my constant growth edges, you know, while on like the human side and in the side that's like, okay, this is us and I need to look at clear eyes with clear eyes at reality. I want to believe like history's going to, you know, like things are going to move and into what I would think of as the right direction. I can hold that, right? I can hold an idea of like in our reality, there is right and wrong. And I want to personally helping to move us in the direction of equity, right? And then there's the deeper spiritual sense, like everything is happening all at the same time. And in a way, it's all kind of perfect and okay. It's one of those things where it's just a paradox. It's both and it doesn't make any sense. But anyway, I felt an eternal nudge to share this idea from coming back to life with you today. Okay, let me get back to chapter 10. The main idea of this chapter is that it's racist to say that all white people are racist and that to be anti-racist is to separate white people from racism and not to conflate the two. So Ibram writes, quote, "Whenever someone says there is something wrong with white people as a group, someone is articulating a racist idea." So maybe you were like me if you just read White Fragility with us. And for me, the first thing that came to mind for me upon taking that in is, oh, well, this is in direct contrast with Robin DiAngelo's main ideas in White Fragility, because as you'll remember, that book was about how white people need to learn to see ourselves through the lens of a group identity and how, as such, we share certain traits, including internalized white supremacy. Then we go back to Ibram, who writes that we must separate the warlike, greedy, bigoted, and individualistic cultures of modern empire and racial capitalism from the cultures of white people. They are not one and the same. And later on, we must discern the difference between racist power, in parentheses, racist policymakers, and white people. And then if we go back up a paragraph, he also writes, to be anti-racist is to never conflate racist people with white people, knowing there are anti-racist whites and racist non-whites. So what are we supposed to do with this discrepancy? I don't know the answer for you. You'll have to come up with your own answer, wrestle with it yourself and see where you land. But for me right now, my answer is to allow myself to sit in the confusion, to hold space for the possibility possibility that even though they are opposing ideas, they could both be true at the same time, and to trust that with time, my understanding and analysis will deepen, and I'll be able to formulate a lens that makes sense to me personally. And that may take weeks or months or years, and whatever the timeline is, I'm okay with it because my commitment isn't to quick and easy answers. My commitment is to a real depth of understanding, however long it takes. And then in this realm, also to note is that Ibram has a recommended reading list. If you go to his website, White Fragility is on it. And as I've mentioned in previous audios, Ibram and Robin have appeared side by side in interviews quite often. So, how do we reconcile that? And right now, you know, even as I'm like sitting in the messiness and the confusion, I'm also feeling this sense of like, oh, because like most things, it's not an either or thing. It's a both and thing. So we can learn to look at common characteristics of white people as a group and learn to look at white people as individuals who, like individuals from every race, racial category, show up as racist in some moments and anti-racist in others. So, yeah, we come back to that both and, to holding the paradox. And this is another reason why when we read White Fragility, I said in the audios over and over again, encouraging people to avoid the tendency to jump straight into talking to other people about their racism, which is something that, you know, an idea that I have seen over and over again in my own learning and unlearning around racism. Because we can see now, if you jump in when you've just done an initial foray into learning, you haven't had time to deepen your analysis or to learn from multiple teachers and then to integrate what we learn into something cohesive and multifaceted that we're able to clearly articulate and back up. So there we go. There's another reason to allow our, you know, like we are like a pot of soup and we can put all these different ingredients into the soup and then we need to allow time for it to simmer, to let the flavors to come together. And then, you know, after a while, we're ready. Like it has turned into something cohesive and unique and we can, it's ready. I don't know if that analogy makes any sense. Hopefully. Okay, let me move on to another main point of this chapter, is that racist policies also have a detrimental impact on most white people. Ibram writes that racist ideas also suppress the resistance to policies that are detrimental to white people by convincing average white people that inequity is rooted in personal failure and is unrelated to policies. So in short, since most white people are not part of the 1%, most white people suffer under policies that increase inequity by benefiting the richest of the rich at the expense of everyone else. And then there's this paragraph in which Ibram does not mince words when he says, white supremacist is code for anti-white, and white supremacy is nothing short of an ongoing program or genocide against the white race. In fact, it's more than that. White supremacist is code for anti-human, a nuclear ideology that poses an existential threat to human existence. Whew. So, this actually makes sense to me because, to me, any ideology that's rooted in hatred is inherently anti-human, because I think that humans are naturally open-hearted and caring, and we forget that, sure, but I think that's our true nature. I'm reminded of how in Radical Compassion, which we read a few books ago, Tara Brach taught us of the idea of the gold in every human, and I think that the gold is our true nature, and therefore any worldview that doesn't come from that place is detrimental to everyone, including those who believe they're placing themselves at the top of that worldview, at the top of the hierarchy within that worldview. And when I think about this, it's interesting. I find that I experience a sense of compassion for Trump and his cronies, because under the worldview they've perpetuated, they're not free either. I would guess that they don't experience much true or authentic love and care in their lives, true or authentic connection with others. And in my view, that's kind of the point of a human existence. Like, we're here to love and to be loved. And so it must be painful to be that closed and disconnected. And that's too bad. You know, my heart hurts for them too. And it really, you know, the saying that until everyone is free, no one is free, it makes a lot of sense. That being said, I think it's important to hold that and to look with clear eyes at, okay, but who is experiencing the most harm from the current situation, and to attend to that first. So as always, we are being invited to mature and grow in our ability to hold lots of different things at the same time. Okay, let's talk about chapter 11, which is called Black. The main ideas of this chapter are that to say that Black people can't be racist is to not look squarely at the Black people in positions of power who have promoted racist policy. Ibram argues that we must acknowledge that people of any race can be racist, which they are if they advance racist policy or otherwise act in ways that perpetuate inequity. So Ibram says the idea that Black people can't be racist because they don't have institutional power, he calls this the powerless defense. And he writes, "This defense shields people of color in positions of power from doing the work of anti-racism, since they are apparently powerless, since white people have all the power. This means that people of color are powerless to roll back racist policies and close racial inequities, even in their own spheres of influence, the places where they actually do have some power to affect change. The powerless defense shields people of color from charges of racism, even when they are reproducing racist policies and justifying them with the same racist ideas as the white people they call racist." And then a little later he says, "When someone says Black people can't be racist because Black people don't have institutional power, they are flouting reality." So Ibram provides some pretty darn compelling examples to support his case. And he starts with statistics about Black people in positions of power, because while of course there are many, many more white people in powerful positions, there's a disproportionate number of white people in powerful positions, there are still Black people in positions of power who use their power to promote either racist policy or anti-racist policy. So he mentions Clarence Thomas, of course, who has been on the Supreme Court for a long time. And the Supreme Court is one of the most powerful positions in the land. And for years, Justice Thomas has consistently made judgments that promote racism. And then he also mentions Ken Blackwell, who is a Black man who was Ohio's Secretary of State during the Bush-Kerry election in 2004. And Ken Blackwell played a key role in suppressing Black votes during that election. And Ibram goes into some detail about this, which I found quite eye-opening. I had no idea. And then he writes, quote, "With the popularity of the powerless defense, Black on Black criminals like Blackwell get away with their racism." And then Ibram also fills us in on a few stories from history that demonstrate that Black people can be racist. And personally, my takeaway is that anyone who craves power for themselves at the expense of others is okay with inequity. as long as it works in their favor. So I would see this as going beyond race, like that craving of power for power's sake kind of goes back to what he said about white supremacy. Like it's an anti-human approach, mindset, because it's going to create hierarchy and it's going to create haves and have-nots. And, you know, it really, you know, I mean, you kind of get to see who someone really is or see what their core values really are. If they move from a place of inequity to a place of like have-nots to a place of the haves, like up on the hierarchy, when they have more power, are they just like, great, more power for me, and now I'm going to enjoy taking advantage of the people under me? And enjoying, oh, I'm better than them. Or now am I going to use my power to try to distribute the power and resources evenly among everyone? I don't know. I don't know if that's, if that, like, people are one or the other, or if our the things that we have learned in our lives, the role models we've had, the values that we have that have been ingrained in us play a big role in that. Maybe it goes back to what our parents taught us in some cases. I don't know. Interesting food for thought. And one more example that Ibram presents in this chapter as evidence of Black-on-Black racism is the idea of them N-word, which is the idea which was popularized by Chris Rock in a 1996 comedy special, that there are Black people and then there are N-word, and that Black people are clearly the superior group. He repeats a refrain that he said earlier in the book, that anti-Black racist ideas are the real Black-on-Black crime. So, the problematic piece of that being, of course, like when you divide Black people into two groups, instead of holding Black people individually responsible for their actions, that's racist, right? When you say there's two kinds of Black people and one kind is clearly better than the other. I've got to say, this chapter makes so much sense to me. I've never been quite able to reconcile the idea that when it comes to the topic of racism, we have to always follow Black people's lead, no matter what they say. Because what if the specific Black person in front of us is spouting racist ideas? So once again, I appreciate what I'm really experiencing as Ibram's ability to keep critical thinking at the forefront, even when it goes against commonly held ideas in his field. That's what we need, right? We need to not just swallow ideas because someone says that they're true. We need to bring our minds, our critical thinking minds, and our intellectual ability to take in what we're hearing and then decide for ourselves if it makes sense or not. Which, of course, is a little more complicated if you're a white person discussing race, because there's just power dynamics and all kinds of other things, but we're figuring it out. I think that is something that we are capable of, and it's messy and it's hard, but I think we're doing it. Okay, let's talk about calls to action for this week. I have two suggestions this week. The first one is to journal or have a conversation with someone on this prompt. Do you agree with Ibram's ideas that not all white people are racist and that Black people can be racist? Why or why not? And then the second suggestion is to write down a list of questions you are wrestling with at this point in the reading, including any that are specific to the discrepancies between this book and white fragility. Okay, friends, that is it for today. I appreciate all of you being here so much, and I will talk to you again next week. Mwah! Love you all. Bye.